We're with a very knowledgeable Robert Zubrin, author of How to Live on Mars, and also the energy book called Energy Victory, Winning the War on Terror by Breaking Free of Oil. We'll open up the phone lines. Both topics are open on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Robert Zubrin, our special guest, and your phone calls. Robert, you ready for some?
Sure. By the way, I just want to mention to people that with respect to Energy Victory, I've got a website at energyvictory.net where people can go and read a number of my shorter articles, and also there's links to where you can buy the book there and so forth.
Very good. Energyvictory.net. And I think we have that linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. First time caller, we'll go to you, Gray, in Bowling Green, Ohio. You're on the air with us. Hi, Gray.
Hello. My question is this. Now, I know there's a modification that you can put on your car in order to burn ethanol, but as a flex fuel. But as far as methanol, I'm not sure of that, because there's a lot of inventory that the big three have that's just sitting there. You know, I know there's going to take them time to retool if they decide to go that way, but what about the inventory that's just sitting there right now?
Well, the problem that we have is this, okay, is there are a certain number of flex fuel cars being sold, about 24 different models sold out of Detroit this year are flex fuel, and they comprise about 3% of the U.S. auto market. But that's not good enough. It's not enough to get gas stations to install pumps. If you own a gas station and you got a couple of pumps, you're not going to dedicate one of them to a kind of fuel that only 3% of the cars can use. So if we simply made it the rule that all new cars have to be flex fuel, then within a couple of years, we'd have a very large fraction of the cars being driven in the country flex fuel, and that would get the gas stations to install the pumps, and then we'd have competition at the pump, and that's what's needed to hold gas prices down.
Okay. Well, my second question would be this. Now, I agree with you and everything that you're saying, but as I understand it, that some of these flex fuel technologies are being developed by the same people who are controlling us now, like Shell Oil. What do we do about that?
Well, no, the flex fuel technologies are developed by the auto companies, not by the oil companies. But once again, you see it's like this. If you wanted to sell newspapers, you couldn't do it if there was no one out there that could read. Okay? If you had some great software that you had produced that could run on computers but couldn't run on computers that use the Microsoft operating system, then you couldn't sell it to anybody, okay? So we have to make the cars compatible with other fuel than what the oil companies are supplying. They still will also be compatible with that. We don't want to give someone else a monopoly either, but we're just trying to open this game up to competition and open up the fuel market to participation from people with biomass resources, coal resources, natural gas resources, even trash dumps, and let them all get in on the act, let them compete against each other, and that's how we keep the price down.
Well, what about human waste?
Well, even the human and animal waste can be converted into methanol, yes, although it's better used for a fertilizer, but it could be, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. You are very, very welcome. Next up, we'll go west of the Rockies. We'll go to Washington State of Gene. Go ahead. Hi, Gene.
Hello, George. It's a milestone moment for me to get through. This is the first time. I'm a longtime listener.
Great.
The last caller stole some of my thunder. About 4 months ago, you had a guest on that was talking about E85 alcohol. He'd written a book.
David Bloom, I think.
Was it? I don't remember his name. It very well could have been. And he got me all excited about it then because it made so much sense. I mean, it's just common sense, it seems, especially hearing now that Brazil is doing it, you know. It seems like such a simple transition. But yet, I guess the key to lock here is a law that requires cars to be built to accept E85. But anyway, my main question is, what is the best source to create E85 alcohol? And I guess it could be ethanol or methanol. I heard that algae is easy to grow and that for some reason, I don't know biology well enough, but for some reason, algae is the best source of alcohol. And I also heard that from, that might have been Bloom, that human waste would be a good source. And the beauty of that is that the leftover product is sterile and can be used for fertilizer.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. There's different fuels here that are under discussion. There's ethanol, there's methanol, and there's biodiesel. Okay, now, algae looks very promising for making biodiesel, which is a good fuel. It can be used in diesel vehicles. Ethanol and methanol can both be used in spark engines, you know, in internal combustion engines, non-diesel cars, which is what most of the cars and light trucks are. The ethanol currently can mostly be made from starches or sugars, such as corn or sugarcane, or frankly, sweet potatoes or wheat or grapes. Anything that has food content in it, frankly, can be turned into ethanol, and has been historically. All the different drinks, whether it's plum brandy or mead from honey or rum from molasses, which is sugar, alcoholic drinks, they're all can be ethanol for cars. And finally, methanol can be made from those kinds of crops too, but it can also be made from woody crops, from cellulose, and from stems and leaves of plants and roots, and basically all biomass. And it can be made from trash. I mean, because after all, paper used to be wood, and so forth. And it can also be made from coal. It is true that waste, or you know, some people have talked about using pig manure, for example, to make some of these fuels. You can make methanol out of it, or natural gas as well. But you have a much larger resource with the raw biomass, plant mass, than the animal waste.
Well, we have people making biodiesel from used restaurant oils now used for deep frying. Is there anything that would stop individuals, and this kind of came up with Howard Bloom, it kind of came up then too. Is there anything stopping individuals from creating 100 gallons of ethanol or methanol in their backyards and fueling their own vehicles if they converted to E85? And second to that, what is the cost of converting an existing, say, 2002 through 2008 GM vehicle to an E85 vehicle?
Okay, on that one, let me answer the second part first. There are a number of conversion kits being advertised on the internet. They're typically around $400. If you could do it yourself, then that's what it would cost. If not, you'd have to pay for labor. Now, one problem with these kits is that there's no certification process in place, so that people don't know whether they're good or not.
Can I go to my GM dealer and put it on a 2002 Avalanche and buy something there and have the dealer put it on?
Well, you might, or, of course, you know, dealers and GM, they get into all this liability stuff and how, you know, blah, blah, blah. You can go to various auto mechanics and so forth that would do it. What I'm saying is that it would be useful if the government was to establish a certification process where the manufacturers of these kits could say, you see, this is certified by the Department of Transportation or something, or even an industry association, just to give people more confidence, because otherwise you're just hearing from the maker of the kit that this is a good kit, let me tell you, because I'm selling it to you, you know. And they may very well be good, but there is no thing there that provides people with the assurance that they would want. The other thing is this, is unless we have a flex fuel mandate on the new cars, we're not going to see the pumps installed. And so not many people would have that much of an incentive to go do one of these $400 conversions. But that said, it's not that big a deal to convert a car to a flex fuel car. And if you make them flex fuel from the start, it only adds about $100 to the cost of a car.
Well, that's not bad. You get your money back on that pretty darn fast, wouldn't you, Robert?
Yes.
Let's go to Texas, Houston. That is Julie. You're on the air. Hey, Julie.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course.
I wanted to suggest that maybe Mars should be a prison planet. No one would escape, would they? And also, it would be interesting to ponder Total Recall, you know, as far as the progression of how the societal, advances might occur.
What do you think, Robert? Prison planet.
I think we got enough prisons already.
You think so?
Yes, I do.
Oh, why don't we just unload our prisons and take them all to Mars, Robert?
Why?
Well, I just don't think we need a prison planet. I think we need a freedom planet.
Yeah, I do too. Unfortunately, it's too much greed for one of those. You'd agree with that?
Well, perhaps, but no. I think we can have a freedom planet. Freedom planet isn't necessarily a utopia. A freedom planet, I mean, because if people are free, they'll do all kinds of things. They'll do good things and evil things. But nevertheless, freedom itself is a good thing. And that is the beauty of an open frontier. That's why, you know, we still look back with longing at the frontier days of America, because they were a time of tremendous freedom. There were all kinds of problems that occur when people are free to do all kinds of things. But nevertheless, that is the happiest form of society.
True. Manhattan, New York. Hey, Bob, you're up with us.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. Yeah, good morning. Sorry I tuned in a little late, but and I don't know if you've covered this. But regarding offshore oil drilling, that began around 1910. In state waters, and I think in the federal waters, it began around 1930, something like that, with over 25,000 offshore oil and gas wells drilled. Do you know how many oil spills of any consequence have actually occurred?
I don't have
because of the offshore drilling. I don't have those either.
I don't have the figure, but
I think I do, but it's hard to find. I think there've only been about 8 or 9, and the last one of any consequence was out in Santa Barbara about 35 years ago. And my point being, offshore oil drilling is very, very safe, and if the feds would open it up to the states and everything, the oil companies would pay billions of dollars for the leases, and the oil royalties could go to the states. Plus, we'd be, which could be used for mass transit needs, taxes, what have you. And we'd have a major source of oil and domestic oil and gas.
Well, I favor expanding the ability to drill offshore. I agree with you on that. However, I do not agree that it would solve the problem. It would help a little, no doubt, and certainly blocking us from doing it is no help at all. But we have to do more than that. We really have to destroy the strategic value of oil internationally. Let me put it to you this way. The United States, well, North America, including Canada, has only 3% of the world's oil reserves. The OPEC countries have 80%. So it's like, I don't know if you play bridge, but, you know, in bridge there's a Trump suit frequently. It has superior powers to all the other suits, and you always want the suit in which your side has most of the cards to be the Trump suit. Well, right now, oil's the Trump suit, and it's the suit in which they are long and we are short. We got to change the game into the one where we have the long suit, or where our long suit is the Trump suit, and that's what the flex fuel cars will do. That's the real game winner.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line, Pocahontas, Illinois. Hey, David, go ahead.
Good evening. You're really onto something here with the methanol. You're absolutely spot on. You know, I don't know how old you are. I'm 52 years old, but ever since I was wearing diapers, every car at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway has run on methanol. I have a neighbor across the street. He has a sprint car. I've helped him with his car. It runs on methanol, develops close to 800 horsepower. The reason that you're absolutely right that we need to have a federal mandate in this is because methanol is corrosive. And if there's any aluminum or magnesium in your fuel system, that the methanol attacks it. So if the car is built with stainless steel fuel injection components, no problem running methanol. You just run it a little richer and you build your horsepower. But you're absolutely spot on, and it is the way to decentralize the transportation side of the energy industry. You're right on, and it's been done for, like I say, over 50 years.
Right, exactly so. And you know, methanol is 105 octane, so your car really goes. And the which is one reason why race car drivers like it. And the other reason is that it's actually safer than gasoline. There's much less chance of a fire in the event of a crash. And if there is a fire, you can put it out with water, which you can't do with gasoline.
That's a good point. Todd in Nashville, you're up with us. Todd, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Hi, Dr. Zubin. I'm excited to talk to you. I grew up in the space age. My father worked, was a manager of the Quick Look program at the Cape from the ground up to Apollo 17. But to get to my point, are you aware of a company called Blacklight Power? It's run by Dr. Randall Mills. It's a gentleman who has figured out a way to take the N1 ground state of hydrogen, use a catalytic process, slamming a catalyst such as argon or hydrogen or sodium into the hydrogen atom, and able to drop it into a ground state, you know, which normal quantum physics says is not possible. And he's able to drop it into what he calls a fractional ground state. Now, Rowan University has just validated one of the first prototypes. He gets a megajoule of energy out of a gram of hydrogen. They heat it up to 300 or 400 degrees, and then the process takes over using sodium hydroxide with in a Randy Nickel matrix. And they've validated this and done it multiple times, and I know they sent this out to a number of other universities for testing. He's just today signed his first contract with a company in, I believe it's not Arizona, but New Mexico, 250 megawatt generation licensing. Are you aware at all of this technology and this what he calls the blacklight process?
No, I'm not. Now, a megajoule out of a gram would be about 100 times the energy density of any
other close,
fuel.
He says it's close to 200 times the energy of burning oxygen and hydrogen together. What it does, it's like a phosphorus reaction where it's not a emission of a photon, because a hydrogen atom cannot emit a photon below that N1 ground state. It can release the energy according to his theory and his practical process. It can release it through a catalytic conversion. If the energy hole matches, it's a 27.9 EV. Hydrogen and helium can work as under certain circumstances. Argon and there's a number of catalysts that will work. But he's found that sodium hydroxide works as a practical room pressure, so it gets a high energy density, about the energy density of a gasoline engine. And he's been developing this for a number of years, went through a number of plasmas and rarefied atmosphere experiments before he found a process that worked that's fairly practical. And he, like I said, it's just now been, the first prototype's been validated by Rowan University. They've got a liquid nitrogen temperature, liquefiable hydrogen. It liquefies at the temperature of liquid nitrogen, about 70 degrees. Higher than the normal.
Hey, Todd, hydrogen. Why don't you hold on for one sec? We're going to take this break, and I do want you to finish your questioning with Robert Zubrin. We'll be back. Well, Friday night, guess what? Yep, Friday into Saturday morning, open lines. Who knows what will happen when we have those. Up next, final phone calls with Robert Zubrin and you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Zubrin with us. And, of course, your calls, author of How to Live on Mars, and then his energy book, of course, called Energy Victory, Winning the War on Terror by Breaking Free of Oil. Energy Victory has been out how long now, Robert?
Energy Victory has been out just about 1 year.
1 year, and this one's just hot off the presses, isn't it?
That's right. How to Live on Mars, publication date was December 9th. It's been out for 3 days.
Who illustrated for you?
Most of the illustrations were done by an artist named Michael Carroll, these were done especially for this book. And I don't know, you can see a lot of them are pretty funny. You know, there's this section here, How to Become Famous on Mars by Making Discoveries, and he points out the fact that, you know, Mars is completely unexplored, so you can make whatever discoveries you want. Who's going to check? And so they've got a painting here of a bunch of people in the middle of the night, and they're in spacesuits, and they're lowering a Triceratops skull into the ground, and it says preparing a fossil for discovery.
Would you be? I would be. I would be bored being one of the first to be on, like, Mars or the moon in some colony.
I would not be. Not on the moon I might be, because there isn't that much to find there. The moon's a rock. But Mars is a place where we might be able to discover life. And if we can discover life on Mars, we'll know whether life as it exists on Earth is the form for life everywhere, or whether we're just one particular form drawn from a much vaster tapestry of possibilities. I mean, we're going to find out about the truth about life in the universe by going to Mars. I think that's pretty exciting. That would keep me going.
Who's Becky Sherman in this book?
Oh, Becky Sherman is a fictional character, but she is the scientist on the first expedition who first discovered life on Mars. So she discovered microbial life on Mars, and that's why her statue is in the center of town. So she's the most famous person in Martian history. And she says, well, if you want to become famous, you got to do the same thing. And of course, someone says, well, how can I do that? It's already been done. And he points out that there's a whole list of things you could discover, if you put your mind to it, especially given the fact that no one can check. And he provides a list of potential discoveries, that you might want to make if you want to become famous. And they start out with things that are fairly conservative and realistic, and he works his way up.
Go ahead.
You a couple?
Yeah, just read me a couple, then we'll go back to Todd, who was talking to you about
space.
Oh,
yeah. Well, you know, he starts out with things like fossils of extinct multicellular organisms, but then he gets into dinosaur footprints, and then rock inscriptions of unknown origins, runes of structures designed for non-humans, alien statues, remains of pre-spaceflight humans, for example, medieval knights, the Holy Grail, the One True Cross, angel skeletons, books or scrolls made of gold foil filled with writing that only you can decipher. And he also recommends some vendors that can provide you with the appropriate fossils to make. So forth. Anyway, it's a fun book. So what the question of this quantum...
Let's go back to him. Go ahead, Todd. You're still with us, right?
Yeah. Okay. Now, obviously, my first instinct years ago was to be skeptical that you could drop the hydrogen atom into a lowered ground state. But as I've been looking at it over the years, he's come up with materials that have been tested at Los Alamos and at different laboratories, and the bomber lines are shifted. His diagnosis is that the reason the chronosphere in the sun is at 1,000,000 degrees versus 10,000 degrees is that it's in that rarefied atmosphere that it's self-catalyzing the hydrogen with the helium, which is one of the catalysts, and that's where that extra energy is coming from, the chronosphere. He's got liquefiable hydrogen that liquefies at 70 degrees Kelvin, and that obviously, if you know, is impossible. He's got it's called a dihydrinohydride, which is two hydrogens in a lower ground state that have formed a molecule. The binding energies, so all the resonance and stuff are shifted. He's got diamond-like coatings that come from this. He's right at the process right now. He's been very open with his theories, which there's a lot of guessing back and forth whether or not he's correct or just, you know, totally off base. But the reality of it is that regardless of his theory, that he's got a verifiable process that will change energy production on Earth. Doesn't necessarily mean that it would be a commercially viable. It depends on the input energies and stuff. But all the chemistry accounted for can only account for 1% of the energy he's getting out in a 15-second burst. There's a megajoule of energy coming out within 15 seconds out of a gram of hydrogen, essentially, and it's repeatable. And Rowan University spent the last 9 months repeating this process, I think 36 times, in a water bath collimator or collimator, I don't know how you say that. But what I'm most excited about is that it will change rocketry, because you can, with binding energies that much lower, you can get a rocket fuel 10 times the energy state of burning hydrogen and oxygen. And there's also the number of chemicals that have higher binding energies that will change the nature of batteries. And he says that you can get lower than just that first ground state. There's 137 states below before you get to the orbital velocity of light where it can't go any lower. Now, obviously, if you're not been exposed to this idea or this theory, there's not much that you can comment on. Other than if this process is true, what the lower ground state hydrogen can do for chemistry and for rocketry, NASA funded a study about 6 years ago where they did, it's called the Blacklight Rocket, and it was under their, with a program they were doing grants of about $100,000, and they got results that they could not confirm as being explainable. There's the CEO of Westinghouse is on the board of directors. There's 16 PhDs. This is not a crackpot. This is not a nuts kind of guy. I'm still a bit skeptical, but if you could comment on if something like
Something like this was true, it would revolutionize space travel. That's for sure. If you're talking about a fuel with an energy density 100 times that of ordinary chemical fuels, which would mean, as you pointed out, I think an exhaust velocity 10 times as great, it would turn space travel into something like air travel. Now, I don't know anything about this. I have to be skeptical. You know, everything I know from physics would cause me to doubt all this, but I haven't seen the data. I think if this person can do this, he ought to make it public, do a demonstration, and put it out in the open, because this could revolutionize life on Earth and the ability of humanity to reach into the universe. But until he shows it, I have to reserve judgment.
Okay, let's go to more callers. Let's go to Al in Sacramento. Go ahead, Al. You're up with us.
Hey, I got a good question for you.
All right.
Speaking of biodiesels and diesels that run on natural gas, we know we get more bang per buck for the ounce of fuel being burnt versus a naturally aspired engine. Why don't we come up one that's one of these little hybrids to where they just hook a nice generator on it that's 500 or 1,000 amps or volts, I mean, and run the car electrically, let the diesel purr along at a constant rate, not using it like a current hybrid to where it varies in its speed, like a generator. Just let it set at a constant rate. Therefore, you can set the fuel burning, you can set the emissions to basically nil, and you've got technically an electrical car with a little diesel generator that's keeping the batteries going and the car going. And you can use pretty small diesel to do that, too.
Well, you know, that makes a certain amount of sense. That this is like a diesel electric system, certain respects like they had on submarines before they had nuclear submarines, although not exactly. But I understand what you're saying. There'd be a lot of advantages to that. Now, there is an issue, though, with cost, because what you're basically talking about there is an electric car, which means lots of batteries. Because your diesel is just to keep the batteries charged, your batteries would need a large capacity, and these batteries are expensive. Because if the battery runs out, then you're just going to be running on a small diesel, and that might chug along and get you home, but that's not how you want to be traveling around.
Well, I'm looking at something like, look at the Toyota Prius. Very small battery pack. They basically got roughly 100 horse and a gas engine. You can put a small three-cylinder diesel in there with almost half the cubic inches. It'll give you the same horsepower if it's running at its higher constant rate, continually charging.
I think the idea has merit. I mean, it has to be looked at in detail in terms of cost. It certainly would give very high mileage because, of course, diesels are efficient, and it's worth considering. I mean, one of the problems, of course, that we've had is, you know, the American automobile industry has been so conservative that, I mean, they have not changed their cars very much in you know, decades. And so, you know, with respect, this idea that you just said is, I mean, clearly an idea worth investigating. And, you know, they have all these engineers working for them. I have to believe that some engineers at GM or Ford or somewhere thought along similar lines at various points in the past, going all the way back to, you know, 1940, people could have done something like this, and yet they haven't.
I think there's a need for some new entrepreneurial car companies.
Absolutely, and we may get them. Driving around in Illinois, Jim, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Jim.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, Jim. Thanks.
Good. Got a suggestion. How about creating a phone line, for, especially for truckers?
We're going to do that.
Okay, good. Now, Robert, I want to punch a big hole in your theory about using methanol for an engine, for fuel. As you know, diesel fuel burns 10 times hotter than gasoline, which we have to have a steel block in order to use diesel fuel. Now, if you use methanol, it burns 30 times hotter than gasoline. And an aluminum block engine, you fill it up and drive 15 miles, you've melted that engine.
Now, methanol burns cooler than gasoline.
No, it does not.
It certainly does. And
Robert,
No, it does. It burns cooler. It's been used in race cars for decades.
Yes,
the previous speaker called, and it's being used in China in cars right now. There's nothing impossible about using methanol in automobiles.
Let me find out. Jim, why do you say it's hotter?
Okay, I'm an ASE certified mechanic. Now, I agree with you that they're using them in race cars, but they're still using the steel block engines, like the caller said, with the stainless steel injectors.
Yes, you want to use stainless steel with methanol. You don't want
right.
to use aluminum.
But aluminum, you cannot use it because methanol will deteriorate and corrode the aluminum.
Yeah, that's why you don't use aluminum with methanol.
So, therefore, your theory is gone out the window about using methanol in American-made cars because of the cafeteria standards set down by Congress that states car makers have to use aluminum block engines.
No, you can use aluminum block engines. You just don't want to use the stuff in the fuel line. Okay, the...
Robert, what you're saying makes no sense because you've got to have that aluminum. And if there's no way around it, so therefore your methanol cannot work in your aluminum block engines.
Look, you could take an existing flex fuel car that's being produced out of Detroit right now and with $30 worth of superior materials used in the fuel lines, you could run methanol in it. And you want to know something? A lot of these flex fuel cars that they're running right now can you use methanol right now because they were originally developed with methanol in mind starting in 1986. Four Tauruses were running on methanol and other cars, and you're just wrong.
Can new engines be developed that'll even bypass this potential problem?
Well, of course new engines can be developed and of various kinds. And, for instance, your previous caller, you know, identified not so much a new engine but a new engine system that had a lot of merit. But, look, this is not a particularly difficult technical problem at this point.
All right, Jim, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Let's look into that, Robert. That he did bring up an interesting point. Perry in Astoria, Oregon. Go ahead, Perry.
I got a question that might take a... Well, we need a little bit of history before I can get to it.
Well, first, we're not going to have time for the history, so...
Okay, well, I'll make it a short history then. You might remember that way back in the original days, gasoline was a waste product left over from producing fuel. They burned it in giant lakes. And somebody said, hey, let's use this in those new horseless carriages. We'll have unlimited fuel for free. But in fact, the automobile was originally designed to run on alcohol. And with minor modifications, it still would run on alcohol. Every internal combustion engine has that capability. We have the ability to make alcohol out of beets and rice and just about everything. I would think that would provide us with an unlimited supply of fuel without any dependence on any foreign oil, gas to liquid or, what's that other one, LNG. Neither one of those are going to reduce our dependency, so that's not the way out. You know what I mean?
Well, I basically agree. And you see, the point about the flex fuel car is it's the ideal transitional technology because the flex fuel car can also run on unleaded. You see, if you had a car that could just run on alcohol, no one would buy it. There's not enough places to fill up. But if you have a car that can run on gasoline and alcohol, people can buy them without any downside because they can keep using gasoline until they start seeing the alcohol pumps appear.
For the transition, I can understand what you're saying. Most fuel tanks could probably be switched over to alcohol pretty safely and cleanly, pretty much overnight. You know, back in World War II, they also had, you know, as you know, there was a great fuel crisis back then. They invented what was called the Pegasus device, petroleum gasification system, and it primarily burnt trash and produced a hydrocarbon that was burnable, able to run vehicles. I've always thought that those could have been used on landfills all along. Use the trash, burn it, provide a fuel, pump it out into the system, you know. But my question is, if I don't hear anybody talking about it, okay, 1965, 289.
I need a question. I got to run.
Okay, quick question.
Give me a question.
That Mustang would get you up to 28 miles to the gallon with no smog devices, catalytic converters, or computers. I watched a guy design a Keith Black Hemi that did 72 miles to the gallon, right? And it was written up in Hot Rod Magazine. And then the idea was bought by Chrysler. This is in the 70s and was never heard from again. And that's my question. Where did that car go? Where did those ideas go? And why are the car companies asking for a bailout when they have not provided us with technology they've had all those years?
Well, those ideas got suppressed. They got bought off and they got put on a shelf, and that's the way they are, locked up in some safe somewhere. Would you agree, Robert?
Yep. And the reason why they're asking for a bailout is because they need the money.
Absolutely. Robert, we're out of time. How to Live on Mars. It's out there now. You can get that in his two websites, energyvictory.net. MarsSociety.org. Robert, my friend, thanks so much. You're always invited on this show. Robert Zubrin. For Karis Coburn, birthday boy Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Shad LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.